Fulton Papers versus the EPA. Ms. Centauri.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Megan Centauri, and I'm before you today on behalf of the plaintiff appellants, Appleton Papers, Inc. I'm also here with co-counsel Heidi Melzer. Today, we ask this court to reverse a summary judgment decision issued in favor of the United States government under the Freedom of Information Act. In the case before you, the district court held that Exemption 5 applied and allowed the government to keep shielded from the public as work product the analysis and opinions of its technical consultants, even though the government had intentionally and strategically offered those opinions in two separate adversarial proceedings to support the entry of two different consent decrees.
What were you hoping to find?
In the documents?
Yeah.
What the technical consultants' analysis did was to come up with estimates for the relative contributions, volumetric contributions, of PCBs to a site in Wisconsin, the Fox River.
You say relative contribution, you mean there are various people that polluted the river, and somebody had already made an assessment who did how much?
The government identified different potentially responsible parties early on. What these consultants did, they came up with a volumetric contribution for each of the potentially responsible parties. In other words, the amount of PCBs that the government's technical consultants contended each release to the river. So it's a series of reports that are at issue. The government first released a report, a 2000 report from this technical consultant. And for example, in that report, one of the PRPs, Fort James, the technical consultant determined had released 39% of the PCBs to the site. The government released that report to the PRPs. It never claimed that the report was work product. It never claimed that the document was confidential. And that report, the complete report, would give the court a good sense of what it is that this analysis did, is contained in the short appendix.
But is there a real dispute that the work product privilege applies to them and all?
There is, Your Honor, Justice Rovner, because...
No, I'm only a judge, but that's...
I'm
okay.
Sorry, Judge. I apologize.
Do
I just
it again.
Elevated
Do
you.
It again.
I elevated you.
No.
Yes. There is a dispute, because what the district court did is the district court found that the technical consultants were non-testifying experts under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26. And when you have a non-testifying expert, then that makes the work that expert did off limits.
Well, I thought that the real issue here was whether or not the government waived the privilege.
That is the crux of the issue as well, but how the district court came at the decision is he found that the technical consultants were non-testifying experts. And so we took issue with that determination by the district court, because when the government used the technical consultant opinions in an adversarial proceeding to obtain entry of the consent decrees, it de facto designated those experts as testifying experts.
So everything produced by Amendola is not covered by the work product privilege?
Correct. It's not covered because the manner in which the government used it here. The government used the work product.
I think we should go home.
No, Judge Rovner. We contend that the work product privilege was waived, but we also contend that they were not entitled to the protections afforded to non-testifying experts under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26, which is what the district court relied on to find that all of the fruits of that work were off limits. We also contend, though, and you are correct, that if the work product privilege applied, and we say it did not, that it was waived when the government intentionally and strategically used it in adversarial proceedings. And what the government did in those proceedings is it had to go to the two different federal courts to obtain approval of consent decrees.
How are you impacted, Ms. Centauri, by this consent decree?
Excuse me?
How is your client impacted by this consent decree?
Because the consent decree allowed a settlement with a PRP at the site, and the government, so they allowed the settlement to release those parties for portions of their liability. There were two different settlements. The first was in 2003, and that was a settlement for natural resource damages and for a demonstration project at the site.
So the second you were not party to the consent decree?
No, the consent decree is between the settling party and the government.
So is your client's concerned that there will be a future lawsuit in involving your client?
My client had initially been designated as a PRP at the site. And so when other parties are released, it leaves the remaining PRPs at the site on the hook. So if a PRP is released and the share that they pay is too low, it leaves the remaining PRPs on the hook. And ultimately, if there is not enough money among the other PRPs, it leaves the public on the hook.
Well, how does that follow? I mean, I appreciate, I think I'm tracking what you're saying.
Sure.
But when would your client come into specific exposure? I understand in the theory you're giving. Doesn't some legal action have to be taken?
Mike, there is an enforcement action pending. The government sued Appleton Papers, Inc., and Appleton Papers, Inc. had incurred more than $175 million under this consent decree. I'm sorry, in the context of the enforcement action, cleaning up the river. My client was then adjudicated to be not a liable party by the district court in that enforcement action.
Right.
They continue to have an interest in the outcome of that case because there is a private indemnity agreement between my client and another PRP at the site. I do want to make...
Well, what I'm driving at is, wouldn't there come a point in time where, I'm not suggesting you wouldn't need information, but you would be able to get it through discovery?
Unfortunately, the discovery and the enforcement action never really got going until right after my client was found not to be a liable party. So my client has not been involved. They've responded to some discovery, but has not been involved in much of the discovery efforts that are going on at the site currently.
Would there come a time when you would have an opportunity to, if you had additional liability exposure, to have discovery?
There could be an opportunity for discovery, certainly, but one point that I want to make that's important to all of this, and we contend, as we've told you in the briefs, this information is critical to my client because the government has used the lowest of three estimates for this PRP that it entered into consent decrees with. But the reason that a party requests information under FOIA should not drive the court's analysis under FOIA. Any member of the public can and should be able to get this information. My client has a particular need for it because of its particular status at the site. But any member of the public should be able to get this information. What the consultants' opinions did is the first 2000 report found that Fort James had released 39% of the PCBs to the site. The 2001 report, which was partially released and is also in the appendix, reduced that number to 28%. The third report, which we have never seen, reduced that number to 15 to 20%. And when the government went to two different courts to get two different consent decrees approved for substantive fairness, it relied on that 15 to 20% number. We've never seen the full report. We've never seen the analysis. They used that to set the upper bound.
But isn't the 15 to 20% apportionment more of a background fact than a dispositive fact? I mean, if it was so key, wouldn't the government have devoted more than a few sentences to that subject in, when they sought the approval for the consent decree?
They used it to make a dispositive point, which was that these settlements were substantively fair. And if you look at both of the decisions from Judge Edelman and then separate consent decree decision from Judge Griesbach, both judges relied upon those particular figures, the 15 to 20%, to bless these consent decrees as substantively fair. So it was a dispositive point. They used it to support the entry of the consent decree. And it was not simply telling the court, as the government contends, that this was their understanding of the facts. These are not facts, as shown by the fact that their technical consultant came up with three different estimates over the course of just a few years.
Your concern, then, is that somebody more is 15 to 20% could well be accountable for a lot more than that.
Exactly.
And
in
of
the
course,
first
if you
report,
get a release, I don't know what it is in, under this kind of a law, but if it were a bank that loaned money to someone and one of the debtors got a release, then everybody else can say, hey, you let him off, you got to let me off. And it's one of those things that a release has a chain reaction.
What happens is the
you
PRP...
You don't release one party without accounting for letting everyone else say it's okay. Now, I don't know what it's like under these circumstances.
Under CERCLA, if you have a set of PRPs at the site and certain PRPs are released, and in this case it's unique because the PRP, it was a partial settlement, so Georgia Pacific is still on the hook for some parts of the remediation at the river. But the if the settlement is too low, it leaves the remaining PRPs on the hook. And the cost of this remediation that the government has estimated is $1 billion. So we're talking about huge amounts of money here. We're talking about the government using this report critically, strategically, in two separate adversarial proceedings, releasing the full 2000 report to the PRPs, releasing part of the 2001 report, and then in 2004, when they go to get the consent decree entered, they use the lowest of the three estimates and suddenly say that when we ask for this stuff under FOIA, that it's all work product, it's all off limits, even though they've used it in the manner that they have.
Okay, so this judge didn't let any of let no documents out. There's been no scrutiny of the documents. The judge said, didn't anybody have anything? Right?
The third report that is the critical report here has never been seen by my client or any other PRP,
well,
is my understanding.
What do you want? You want the whole report? Or
we want the whole
report,
Your Honor. We want the whole the third report, the whole report. We want the facts and data relied upon by the technical consultants. We want the full 2001 report because only a partial copy had been released. And we want any remaining parts of the 2000 report that had not been released.
So based on the approval of that release, you want the documents that somehow or other, I don't know, led to that conclusion, I guess.
We want all of the documents. We want all of the documents that the technical consultants relied upon, the facts and data that they relied upon, as well as the full report.
And I assume that they relied upon, but somebody, the court or somebody, relied upon to do the 15 to 20%.
They relied upon the 15 to 20% analysis, estimate, opinion that these technical consultants.
In order to arrive at the 15 to 20%.
Correct, Your Honor. And if I may, I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Surely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jed?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. As I think plaintiff concedes at this point, because this is a FOIA action, questions about the particular impact in CERCLA litigation or the particular fairness in the CERCLA litigation actually have nothing to do with the dispute that's before this Court right now. The only question is just whether these documents are covered by the work product privilege, which I think plaintiff concedes at this point. Plaintiff no longer seems to dispute that facts are not covered by the work product privilege, and then simply whether the government has waived the work product privilege. So all of these fairness concerns and talking about how much liability there is, I mean, I'm happy to discuss all of those, but I think as Judge Rovner got to in her earlier question, that's an issue for discovery before the district court. If this party or if any other party in the CERCLA litigation thought that it was important or necessary to see those documents, the district judge could have required that particular documents could have been produced. There could have been a debate at that point about privilege and what would be produced. And I should point out, by the way, that in one of those pieces of litigation, in fact, API did ask that at least some of these materials be produced. The government objected to that on a variety of grounds, including asserting the work product privilege. The district court ruled on a particular ground where they said, look, this 15 to 20% figure that you're talking about, maybe it's linked to some of the government documents, but in fact, it's consistent with API's own documents. But that's all a matter for that district court that has nothing to do with this FOIA action.
Okay, but wait a minute. What was the relevance of the 15 to 20% figure? Was it cited by way of delimiting someone's liability?
So my understanding of what happened in the earlier rounds of CERCLA litigation is that the ENRD, the Environmental Division of the Department of Justice, and the state of Wisconsin named many different polluters as potentially responsible parties. Some of the polluters wanted to settle, and other polluters did not want to settle. And, of course, there was a dispute about who would settle for how much. And so when a particular settlement is reached, what happened in the the litigation where API was involved, for example, is they set up a consent decree. And they said, okay, you, a particular settling party, will be responsible for a particular amount. So in the decision that Your Honor was referring to, Georgia Pacific was trying to settle a particular claim, and the question was, well, how much of this pollution is Georgia Pacific responsible for?
Exactly. So everybody's going, let's just take there's a 100%, there's a finite number. There's still not a determination. Somebody estimates $1 billion. So whoever got this 15-20%, if it turns out to be $2 billion, they're still responsible for 15-20% of that $2 billion?
I don't know the exact details of the consent decree or how liability will transfer over. I do know that the district court issued a partial final judgment under 54B with regards to Georgia Pacific when that consent decree was approved, and I know that there is still ongoing litigation with regards to the other parties. I don't know whether a check has been cut yet, and if so, exactly how that will be calculated based on the consent decree.
Now, they say they aren't eligible for discovery. They say they're out of the picture, so-called, and the only way they can go through is FOIA. Obviously, if they were part of litigation, you go discovery and you have all of these rules. I guess there are different rules for FOIA, and I don't know what power they have to do anything about it.
Well, whether they can or cannot get discovery at this point is entirely irrelevant to the FOIA question. The FOIA question is whether any person on the street could access these privileged documents. And whether I can get them or some guy in the street can get them or API can get them, the answer is the same with regard to all of those questions.
Well, it wouldn't be under discovery and litigation and that sort of thing.
That's absolutely correct,
well,
Your Honor.
We keep saying that it would be better if we were under that process, but we're not.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. If this was discovery, some of the arguments would potentially be different. As we discuss in our red brief, in normal civil litigation discovery, there are sometimes need-based exceptions. And so when a variety of plaintiffs' opening brief talks about fairness and proper presentation of facts to the court, those are the sorts of arguments both under Federal Rule of Evidence 502 and under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26b3 that a court can consider. But those questions are not relevant to a FOIA action.
Okay. So under these circumstances, the judge feels no obligation to go sifting through this pile of documents and finding which is which. He just says he can't have any of them.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I want to focus in on the details of that particular in-camera review argument that plaintiffs have renewed in their reply brief. Plaintiffs' argument to the district judge, I believe, was the same argument that they made in their opening brief here, talking about in-camera review, which is that they wanted some of the factual material, and the judge should go through and see whether factual material had properly been segregated out. As we point out in our responsive brief, it is black-letter law that factual material is still covered by the work product doctrine. The work product doctrine, if you look at just the text of Rule 26b3, covers the document, whether there's fact in it or opinion in it. Every circuit to have addressed this has concluded as much. So there's no need to go through and segregate out privileged material from other privileged material. And I should actually just add, by the way, as the district judge pointed out in his opinion in response to plaintiffs' desire to have some kind of in-camera review, plaintiffs didn't really give any particular focused reason for why it is that he should review these documents or even ask that he review particular documents. I mean, obviously, in this case, there are 101 documents at issue, although now apparently at oral argument, plaintiff really just seems to be focusing in on only one or two of them. But there
I assume that you're talking about documents, not pages.
That's correct, Your Honor. Some of these documents are just individual emails sent between Justice Department attorneys or Justice Department attorneys and consultants. Some of them are obviously much longer packages. And, of course, the rule has to be the same whether there are 10 documents at issue or 10,000 documents at issue.
What is it that the EPA needs to keep secret? Why is all this? I mean, this sounds to me like something, you know, that it's bad or whatever, and the pollution, but why does it have to be that this can't be disclosed?
Sure. Just to be clear, Your Honor, there were actually both EPA documents and Department of Justice documents at issue.
Right.
Plaintiff has not appealed the decision about the EPA documents. The various Department of Justice documents are, I mean, you know, internal documents that are produced as part of litigation, I think.
Okay, I understand. It's not. I can't pin it on the EPA then.
Sure.
That happens to be the party who's sued.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
Where I'm a bit confused was I kept wondering what would be the point of an in-camera review if everything produced, was covered by the work product privilege. But now I may be wrong.
No, Your Honor, I think you're absolutely right. That's exactly the point that we make in our responsive brief.
I know.
Plaintiffs wanted in-camera review. Their initial claim for it was they thought that factual material wasn't covered. But, in fact, factual material is covered. We cite a pile of cases for that. They don't really even seem to contest that in the reply brief. So I don't even know what it is that they want in-camera review of. Unless Your Honors have any other questions about the B3, B4 confusion or the waiver issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No.
Ms. Santard.
Thank you, Your Honors. I clearly did not do a good job of explaining in the first half why the documents are important. When a party is named a PRP at a CERCLA site, like my client was initially, those parties are jointly and severally liable for the entire cost of the remediation unless they can prove that the site is divisible, meaning the harm that they caused is divisible from the other harm. The government used these documents in a consent decree to obtain the blessing for settlement with Georgia Pacific and to show substantive fairness, in other words, that the amount of harm caused by Georgia Pacific was in line with the amount of the settlement that they were reaching with Georgia Pacific. They offered this 15 to 20% number, the lowest of the three estimates that their technical consultants did. And it used that upper bound to get these two different federal courts to agree that the settlement was substantively fair. And my client believes, and their analysis is, that Georgia Pacific's responsibility at the site is much higher than that. So these documents are very important to the ability to prove joint and several liability. That's why they're important.
What's the vulnerability of your client? I want to make sure I understand that. What they've so-called, what was their decision? Not what?
My clients were determined by the federal court to not have liability under CERCLA after they had already incurred more than $175 million cleaning up this site.
Do they want their money back?
They continue to, they are actually seeking their money back. There is also, they have a interest in the ongoing remediation, which is still happening right now as we sit here today, because they have a private indemnity agreement with another PRP at the site for a portion of the cost. What is important for the court to understand is that the documents the government is using, they are using it in a selective and misleading manner, and they've been allowed to have their cake and eat it too. Because in the litigation right now, they use the 2001 number. In a deposition the other day, they were using the 2001 number. But they're not using not giving us the full information. I will also point out that in the 2001 report that they did, the share that was assigned to the companies that were alleged to have been predecessors of my client went down as well. We're interested in the third document because our number may have the share that they have said is attributable to NCR, which is a different company, which is the company that we have the private indemnity agreement. That number may have gone down as well. I also want to make the point that we are not conceding that the 101 documents are not fair game. We are asking primarily for the 2003 or 4, whatever the year is, report, as well as for the full 2001 report, as well as all of the facts and data that were relied upon by those technical consultants, and those are not covered by the work product privilege. That information is fair game and should be released, and it is not protected by FOIA's Exemption 5. And I believe that I'm out of time.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.